Hi, I'm Dr. Hillary McBride. Normally, therapy sessions are totally confidential, but in other people's problems, I open the doors to let you hear sessions with my long-standing clients. This is what people sound like when they talk with someone they trust about healing addiction, parenting stress, racist ideologies in the family, and other topics that feel so timely as we come through this difficult time. Other People's Problems, available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
I'm Dr. Brian Goldman. This is White Coat Black Art. The Canadian Medical Association says within the decade, nearly 1.5 million of us will need home care.
Yes.
And how many hours are you supposed to be getting?
Right now, 16 a week.
And how many are you getting?
Zero.
Been on the waiting list since March.
On a waiting list?
Yeah.
What do you think of this?
I think it's incredibly horrible. I mean,
Kirsten McDonald, age 55, was diagnosed with ALS late last year. Her 61-year-old husband, David, is Kirsten's full-time caregiver and does hours of backbreaking work every day.
I've had to quit work and take care of my wife. I have to be very careful about my own burnout because, first off, it's really stressful, you know, with a wife with a fatal illness and the emotional stuff, and then dealing with a six-year-old who is trying to make sense of all these changes to mommy. And there's all the sort of physical stress of lifting and moving and transferring her in bed and then rolling her over in bed. She can't roll over in the bed, so I'm up at 3 a.m., 4 a.m., 5 a.m.
Families like the McDonald's drain their life savings on care and equipment the system can't provide. Seniors wait years for long-term care while at risk of falling at home because home care can't keep them safe. These stories and others add up to a crisis. I want you to meet someone who is trying to dust some of the cobwebs out of Canadian healthcare.
That's huge. I think education and healthcare are the two that haven't cracked new models of working, and it figures we're also the last to go digital. I always said it's us and the lawyers still using fax machines. No, they gave it up during COVID. Not us.
Zaina, what's your fax number? You remember that? What's your fax number?
Or your pager number? Then I always say.
She's VP at Teladoc Health, which delivers virtual healthcare. Before that, she led the Futures team at SE Health, a not-for-profit that is one of Canada's biggest home care providers. It was in that role as medical futurist where Kayat led efforts to revamp home care completely. Zaina Kayat, welcome to White Coat Black Art.
Excited to be here.
Excited to be speaking to you. Zaina, as a futurist, how do you view home care as it's being delivered here in Canada right now?
You know, I came at St. Elizabeth Healthcare is where I was, I think, the first ever and only futurist in home care in the world, let alone in Canada, because I knew the future of all healthcare will be in the home. It'll be very unusual to go to these places called clinics and hospitals to get care, just like you don't go to the bank to get cash anymore, but you go there sometimes. So I wanted to be part of creating that. And wow, did we have a big starting point that I think overwhelmed me in terms of how far we have to go to really realize the future that patients deserve.
Can you walk me through, you know, what happens when someone needs extra support at home right now? Just take me through the assessment steps right through to the delivery of the care, if it happens.
Yeah, I'll give the Ontario example, but it's generally the same around the world. You know, you get to a point where somebody, let's say, can't manage alone at home or on their own. And then, you know, some flag is raised that says you need home-based care. So sometimes you can self-refer if you know enough or somebody tells you how to do it. You can directly contact, it used to be in Ontario called the Local Health Integration Network, LHIN. So you're kind of local broker, if you will. Or your physician might do a referral, which is an online form that they do. I think they fax it, Brian, today.
They still fax it.
They fax it into this center thing. If they even know how, that whole communication's broken. Or the whole thing usually starts from you being in hospital. Let's say you had a heart attack or you've had a COPD exacerbation. And the only way safely you could be discharged home is if some extra support was provided at home to keep you safe and not coming back. So that might initiate out of there where there's some kind of a discharge plan out of the hospital. But either way, it comes in and then some central person, some kind of administrator or coordinator at this government agency will do an assessment with an evidence-based set of questions. They're pretty standard. And then based on that, it'll spit out a decision about, you know, how needy you are and what kind of services you need. And we decided that we're going to organize all of this into three types of services and only three types that are literally three separate contracts with like a third party agency. One is nursing care, which is for medical things. One is personal support type care in your home and cleaning and light care. And then the third is what we call therapies. So physiotherapy, occupational therapy, speech language therapy, social work. So any one of those three types of people will get a certain number of minutes or hours a day, a week. They could be from three completely different agencies. And then they kind of come to your house, you know, on some kind of a cadence of a schedule.
Now, you've sort of, just by the tone in your voice, you've sort of talked about some of the shortcomings. But can you break it down more? What's wrong with the system as it's set up?
I mean, I think there's a whole overall structural thing. Like, you know, we love in medicine to organize humans so cleanly to reduce them to things that help us organize our services, diseases and body parts, right? And care settings versus something a bit more holistic. Because if you're at a point of needing home care, you've probably got a lot of things going on that are very intermingled. And so you can't separate the body and the issues into discrete professional services. That's one. Two is the idea that a one-time phone-based assessment, often with people who don't speak English or who are not at their best, don't have a family caregiver present, is going to set you off on a course for, you know, what's going to happen next. And it's, you know, decided how many minutes or hours you get. You know, to me, Brian, that's the same as when we used to route students in grade 9 and say, you're not university material because we did this assessment in grade 9. You know, and that's it. You're kind of set for life.
And, you know, just to give some other examples that I know more personally, one client in home care might need an hour to be fed. Another client might need to be changed and toileted. Another one might need to be helped to the toilet. A fourth client might need to be helped to walk. And another one might need to be turned in their bed to make sure that they don't get pressure sores. And you're saying that this system doesn't assess those individual needs very well.
I mean, I'd say those blunt needs, I think there is flexibility. And, you know, I worked in this sector and my mother is a personal support worker. That's actually how she entered the workforce at 65.
So at 65?
At 65. Her first time going to school and her first job. A great immigrant story.
But Zaina, whose job is it to know what those individual needs happen to be from person to person and how they're changing over time?
In my view, and this is how the leading home care systems in the world, and the one example it's been written about and studied to death here in Canada, is the Buurtzorg home care model in the Netherlands.
Buurtzorg is a pioneering healthcare organization established in 2006 with a nurse-led model of holistic care that revolutionized community care in the Netherlands. Our organization is formed by a network of nurses who work in small-scale, self-managed teams to provide home care in neighborhoods. When we started in 2006, our approach was radically new because it had fundamentally different characteristics from the dominant approach in healthcare.
Buurtzorg is seen widely as one of the most important advances in home care to come along in decades. Instead of caring for clients, it cares for a neighborhood of clients. To do that, Buurtzorg organizes into teams of nurses who care for as many as 60 clients within the neighborhood. Compared to home care in Canada, nurses in the Dutch system devote more hours to direct contact with their clients. As a medical futurist with SE Health, Zaina Kayat worked on a pilot that brought the Buurtzorg model of home care to Canada.
You know, scholars of business books write about Buurtzorg for how to do org design and structure services, not in healthcare, in any industry. That's how advanced it is. The way it should work, Brian, is, you know, somebody needs care. The delivery agency or person who's the closest to delivering that care, they decide the care plan and they just constantly redo the assessment and adjust the care plan in real time. That's how it should be done. And it can be done at scale, very cost effectively, with amazing, better outcomes than what we do today. It is not impossible.
On the public dime?
On the public dime. And
wow.
I worked on building that model in Canada for 4 years, Brian. And we had to stop during COVID because nobody was interested in creating the future. It was just too many emergencies of the day to deal with.
One of the other things that was found out during COVID is that we don't have enough frontline personnel. We don't have enough frontline PSWs, and we certainly don't have enough nurses because that's what we've been hearing about lately.
Yeah. I mean, so it's bad enough in, let's say, acute care when, you know, ERs are closing, and you've been very vocal about what you're seeing on the front line, that we don't have nursing staff and other staff in our traditional facilities. But you look at home care. I mean, to me, the care workers in home care is the apex of sexism, racism, and ageism all in one, because these are often immigrants who are not highly educated, can't advocate, and they need the work. The pay is awful, Brian. You know, if it's personal support, you know, we're competing with Tim Hortons on wages. And if it's nursing, you're competing with hospitals who have a union and have, you know, pensions and benefit plans. And that isn't conferred in home care. And so there's not a lot of attraction when one, pay is not, you know, at par. But secondly, and again, people get into home care for mission and purpose, not to make bazillions of dollars. But then when you get there, you have no autonomy, no power. You can't work to the best scope of your training and make decisions at the bedside. That's, to me, where the moral injury really comes. And then people leave.
But all of that was going on before COVID, wasn't it?
Yeah, but now you add, you're asking them to wear masks, wear gowns, take it off, put it back on in between visits. I think in our estimate, it was about 30% extra time was added just for the IPAC protocols, the infection control and prevention protocols. And you go into the patient's home, and as much as you want to have rules, you know, you go to a hospital and you don't wear a mask, you're not going in, right? You
right.
can't. In the home, you're there to do their care, and they don't believe in COVID. They don't want to wear a mask. They beg you to take yours off. Like, it's a very difficult environment in the home where you cannot control the variables the way you can when the patients have to come to you. And those trade-offs become enough, you know. And then I'll just add, and this has been my mom's personal experience, she's had most days where she makes negative money doing home care. Negative.
Why?
Because of gas prices. So remember, when you do home care, you're conferring the cost of your real estate onto the patient for sure, right? It's their lights, it's their walls, it's their beds, it's their electricity. But you're conferring the cost of transportation onto the care provider. And the cost of that transportation is not really covered in the current contracts.
We'll be right back.
From CBC Podcasts and the Fifth Estate, Brainwashed is a multi-part investigation into the CIA's experiments in mind control. From the Cold War and MKUltra to the so-called War on Terror, we learn about a psychiatrist who used his patients as human guinea pigs and what happens when the military and medicine collide. Listen to Brainwashed on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to White Coat Black Art. This week, what's wrong with Canadian home care and how to fix it? Zana Kayat says the current system in Canada is too inflexible. It doesn't tailor services to the immediate needs of clients. She says personal support workers, the key service providers, are grossly underpaid and spend too much time and too much money on gas traveling from client to client. COVID and inflation have made worse these and other shortcomings. As a result, there's a greater sense now that the system is broken. Here's more of my conversation with Zana Kayat.
So what we end up with, what we have right now, what we heard last week on White Coat Black Art, are people, clients, who are promised so many hours a week, they qualify for so many hours a week of home care, PSW, nursing, etc., but the home care provider can't provide them because there aren't enough people to
You're
do
listening
that.
To White Coat Black
Art.
That? This week,
we know what
what's
the demand is, but
Canadian
we don't have the supply, and it's mostly
it.
Human labor.
Zana Kayat
to
says
meet the demand,
system
it's
in Canada
just you feel it acutely
inflexible.
When you're sitting around at home and you
it
can't get out of bed.
Doesn't tailor services to the immediate
the
needs of clients.
Bed isn't there.
She says
so it's a real problem.
Workers,
and again, our answer with most things in home care is like I'm going to say, Brian, 99%
money
labor.
On gas.
Oh, Zana, but I want to be clear about one thing. I'm not slagging your mother, and I'm not slagging any frontline worker.
Not at all.
I'm asking you about the system that says you qualify for 16 hours a week, but we can only provide 8 or maybe none. Yeah. What do you think of a system like that?
Massive imbalance between demand for services and supply of people to do it. I've seen very skilled home care. Like, it takes you a while to be good at it, to know your relationships. And like, it's just a constant revolving door, right? So So that's why it's like that. And you know, what do I think of the system? I mean, I think we ration care. So the answer is always throw more bodies, just recruit more, get immigrants, train more, more and more, volume, 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 higher, higher. I remember, you know, most home care agencies, Brian, you want to guess how what their turnover is in a year?
I'm going to guess 100%.
It's not exactly 100, but it's about 30%. So all you're doing is constantly recruiting, onboarding, and then they're gone within 60 or 90 days. Like, we know exactly when they quit.
I just happen to know that the fast food sector's turnover is 100%.
Yeah. Fundamentally, it is this thing of dynamic care, static infrastructure. You know, Brian, static infrastructure is saying a nurse can only do these tasks. So imagine for your sister, you know, there's a nurse, you got given certain hours to do nursing care, like medical stuff. But she's there and she sees that the bed hasn't been done or the laundry wasn't taken out or, you know, the coffee maker is molding. Like in Bertzorg in the Netherlands, they just do it. They don't say, oh, we're going to wait till Wednesday when your personal care comes. And guess what? The personal care doesn't come because there's no staff. So that's to me another example of static infrastructure, like putting people into cones of expertise and not allowing them to cross boundaries. And everything is crossing boundaries in healthcare.
Well, but if you propose that in Canada right now, you would probably anger the people who run those various silos of professionalism, wouldn't you?
You will and you won't. So I think if the value is there and the mission of why people kind of came to home care is what we focus on, actually, in the end, it saves the profession. And that's exactly what happened in the Netherlands and other large health systems that are migrating to this model of home care, such as Kaiser Permanente in California. It brings joy and love back to the profession, whether you're a nurse, a physiotherapist, or a personal support worker.
Can you take us back to the project you were working on for 4 years that was so disrupted by the pandemic? Is that a jumping off point?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we were, you know, interested in creating at scale the model like what they do at Bertzorg in the Netherlands. At St. Eliz, you know, we had designed it already from, you know, 112 years of home care experience. But the tipping point was the fact that it was scaling so fast out of the Netherlands. Like, I think they were by then in 45 countries, China, Germany, Denmark, Sweden, the whole UK, Kaiser Permanente, like all over the world, advanced health systems that want to be part of the future and not the past were adapting and embracing this model where basically, I'll just summarize it in a nutshell, four big departures from everything you and I just talked about. One, the agency and the nurses and the professionals closest to the patient do the assessment and decide the care plan, not some central agency. They then get given a budget based on the needs of the patient, and then they decide what mix of expertise, in-home visits, virtual visits, technology, humans. They mix it up. As long as they hit the results, they decide how they want to orchestrate and use the budget.
And if they spend less, they keep the extra money. And if they spend more, then they're going to have to figure it out.
You figure
it out. How to save money the next time.
But it balances out because of the third big change is you give a neighborhood or a population, and they had parameters they've learned over the years, and that's the responsibility of a team. It's like an Avon sales rep. You just have the neighborhood. So it's called the neighborhood care model. So that's how you can make it work in a day. You figure out, how am I going to take care of the health of the neighborhood? You're also geo-bound, so you don't have my mom driving 45 kilometers to, you know, Tecumseh, Ontario, and then, you know, her next visit in 15 minutes is another hour in Lymington, right? And then wondering why she didn't show up for the visit because we have no ability to schedule properly. So you take care of a neighborhood, but when you take care of a neighborhood, then guess what? Your patient is also the neighborhood. So you're going to form relationships and ties with all the assets in the community because it takes a village to take care of somebody at home. It doesn't take 25 minutes of PSW care three times a week. And then the fourth biggest one, Brian, is you pay the people on salary. You don't pay them by the minute or by the hour. You don't incent them to kind of crank up their hours. And you pay them a good salary, like 40% higher than what we pay here. And you have no back office. There's no managers. There's no bosses. It's a fully decentralized model with all the money goes to the people closest to the patient.
How easy would this be to implement in Canada right now?
So, I mean, look, when we wanted to put some investment because St. Eliz has, you know, we're a nonprofit, so we had a lot of investment we could get. We had great partners to also invest. It's like R&D, right? It's an R&D for a business model for home care we had to do. Everybody wanted it. Everybody's been, Brits are kind of got tired. They're like, you Canadians, all you do is call us and we keep explaining what we do. When are you going to actually do it? And that was like my vision is let's do it with my CEO and with the team. And so, you know, in practice, it wasn't that hard to kind of convince the payers. So we had to convince a couple of LHINs, the local health integration, to say, here's the budget you would have paid us for the old school model, the transactional that you and I just described. Give us the same budget for the same population and give us a year to try this model and see if we hit some of the measures that have been published. So we were about, 8-10 months into that pilot, then we had to pull the plug because there was just no more interest in investing in the R&D given, you know, as you might remember, during COVID, volumes dropped significantly in home care. So the house was on fire. So, you know, we had to stop.
But now we have a huge crisis in long-term care.
Yeah.
Is this not the best time to be doing this?
I mean, there always was a best time. We're like, give us that budget if you would have had a bed and let us take care of them at home and let us show you the results we can get. And there wasn't a single visionary, risky, gutsy policymaker or decision maker that wanted to go down that dance with us. And Brian, it's the same with ER. Give me the budget that you would have spent on your ER if you had unlimited capacity and let me take care of those patients at home. It's totally possible and other health systems are doing this.
Well, I hope that the people who run those healthcare systems in Canada have been listening to our conversation. Zaina Khayat, this has been a revelation. Thank you so much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Brian.
Zaina Khayat is not the only expert looking outside Canada for new ways of providing home care.
We appreciate that the system's in a crisis, but we know that there are other solutions than stripping people's rights and almost distracting people away from the real solutions. We're not talking about home care. We're not talking about, you know, just retaining the nurses that we have and making our healthcare system a better place where people want to work.
As a leading geriatrician, Dr. Samir Sinha sees how inadequate home care affects his patients. I spoke with Dr. Sinha at his office at Sinai Health System. You might occasionally hear the faint sound of an MRI machine. Dr. Sinha's office just happens to be right underneath the hospital's X-ray department. Dr. Samir Sinha, welcome back to White Coat Black Guard.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
What grade would you give to home care in Canada right now?
I'd give it a D minus.
A low grade.
It's a low grade. It's not a failing grade. But it's not a grade that I think anybody would be proud to show their own mother or their own friends, because we really do have a system that is not as innovative as it can be. It's not as well funded and supported as it can be. It's not as respected as it should be as a real key way that we could move our healthcare system forward to meet the needs of an aging population.
I wanted to get Dr. Sinha's take on the clients of home care, people like David and Kirsten McDonald, whose story we heard last week and at the top of this week's show.
On our show last week on the deficiencies in home care here in Canada, we visited the home of Kirsten and David McDonald. Kirsten has ALS, diagnosed in December of 2021. Her husband, David, has put his business on hold to spend 14 hours a day as a solo caregiver. He's 61, by the way. We saw it. It's back-breaking work.
You know, these stories break my heart because I hear them all the time. And this is clearly a situation where if we could get them more support, it could actually stabilize the situation at home. It could actually give David a bit of a break. It could actually allow him to not burn out too quickly, because if David doesn't last, what happens to David, their child, Kirsten? We could certainly support families like David and Kirsten to be able to get the right amount of care they need to support Kirsten to stay in her home as long as possible, and to make it possible to potentially for David to even return to work, and to support his family in other ways. Because right now, the current way we're treating this family is it's hard for them to bring in any income. That's not helping their future prospects or David's future retirement plans or what they want to do as a family. But most importantly, it's going to shortchange Kirsten in terms of her goal of being able to stay at home for as long as possible with her family. this could get expensive very quickly for our healthcare system unless we provide people like Kirsten and David and their child the support that they need to try and make it work at home where they want to be.
You wanted to talk about other countries. You've championed Denmark as a country that's a model for home care. So what stands out to you about home care in that country?
Well, what Denmark did strategically is they had a healthcare system that was having the same issues that we were having. They had people who were living in hospital, being held hostage, as they like to say, who were waiting there to try and get home with home care or for a long-term care bed. And they said, wait a minute, all of these people, all these Danes, just like all these Canadians, they want to be able to be in their own homes for as long as possible. So what happens if we just use that math to actually invest more money in home care and provide a much more robust system? So Denmark, for example, spends twice what we do in Canada on providing long-term care services. That's home care and nursing home care. But two-thirds of their spending are actually on high-quality home care, only one-third on nursing home care. And so if we actually just took that approach, you'd see incredible results. In Denmark, there is nobody waiting in hospital for a long-term care bed or for home care. And finally, they've actually closed thousands of hospital beds because they didn't need them, because people were no longer just sitting there waiting, where right now in Ontario today, 25% of our current hospital beds have folks in them who are titled ALC, or alternate level of care, because they should be somewhere else in the system, but we don't actually have the capacity in the other parts of the system with home care, with long-term care, with rehab, palliative or hospice care that could actually provide them those supports.
Thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Here is what we can take from Dr. Samir Sinha and Zaina Khayat on how to fix home care. Instead of increasing long-term care beds, pour those funds into home care. Eliminate central administration and instead have frontline nurses and PSWs decide what services are best for clients based on close knowledge of what those clients need. It remains to be seen if the provinces are willing to risk trying a new approach. That's our show this week. If you have a story to tell about home care, our email address is whitecoat@cbc.ca. Whitecoat Black Art was produced this week by Amina Zafa with help from Jeff Goods and Dose producer Jason Vermesh. Our digital producer is Philip Drost and digital writer is Jonathan Orr. Our senior producer is Colleen Ross. That's medicine from my side of the gurney. I'm Brian Goldman. See you next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.